Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, our Races to Watch series takes us to Newcastle County for a closer look at the 9th House District campaign, a rematch between incumbent Republican Kevin Hensley and Democratic challenger Terrell Williams, and the 22nd House District race that sees Republican Mike Smith face Democratic newcomer Monica Beard. And an environmental geographer joins the show with some insight into why the once invisible threat of salt in Delaware's water is getting worse.
Do we want to work against nature, or should we just work with nature and see for how long we can save this land?
We also get an update from contributor John Hurdle on where Delaware stands with PFAS contamination as the state continues to battle the presence of forever chemicals. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon, and that's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned in to a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon, sitting in for Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is highlighting a series of races to watch. And the next race we're looking at ahead of November's general election is in Newcastle County. The race for Delaware's 9th House District, which includes portions of the Middletown, Odessa, and Townsend areas, is a rematch, pitting incumbent Republican Kevin Hensley against Democratic challenger Terrell Williams once again. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny examines where things stand in the district as the two face off for a second time.
The last time around, in 2022, Hensley, a five-term incumbent, won easily, pulling in some 1,200 votes more than Williams and bringing home a 12-point victory. But there's no guarantee history will repeat. Williams, the Democratic hopeful, sees a district ready to flip. He joined me on the campaign trail at a coffee shop in Odessa.
How are
you? Good to see you, brother.
Likewise. I guess the big difference is we have had an influx of people move into the 9th district that are unfamiliar with State Representative Kevin Hensley and his legislative record.
And the numbers back Williams up. On paper, the 9th district looks eminently winnable for Williams, even kind of a cakewalk. After all, registered Democrats outnumber Republicans about 10,000 Democrats to just 5,900 Republicans. Another 6,200 voters don't belong to either party. It's a Democratic edge that's grown by about 500 over 2 years, and that's a point Williams is trying to hammer home.
I believe my policies and my platforms represent 80% of this district, where his policies, his legislative record, only represents 10 to 20%. That means when he's down in Dover and he's making decisions on behalf of the people of the 9th district, he leaves out 80% of the district.
Yes, the district is changing, says Hensley. But he's running on his record and his time in office.
I feel that my number one goal is to serve the folks in my community and solve problems for them.
And Hensley says his win in 2022 shows he can win over independents and get crossover votes. He calls it a necessary skill when your party is in the minority in the House, and he highlights what he says is his bipartisan reputation.
I've worked 10 years being in the minority, and it really comes down to establishing relationships. If you look at the legislation that I've sponsored during my tenure in the House, I've been quite effective in reaching across the aisle in order to gain bipartisan support.
Still, Hensley says, there's no denying that the district is growing and changing.
We have a lot of young families that are coming, largely from out of state, and they're coming for a number of reasons. Clearly, housing affordability, the strong school district.
The influx of new families highlights something that both candidates say is a major issue in District 9, growth and the need for infrastructure to support that growth. Terrell Williams again.
We have outgrown our resources in the state of Delaware, and I don't think we as a state have adjusted to that.
Hensley echoes that sentiment.
I feel like we're playing catch up when it comes to the infrastructure part of the overall picture of growth and transportation throughout the area. And we need to do a better job of coordinating our efforts with the county as well as the state DLDOT primarily.
Hensley notes that in the House, he brought forward bills that made infrastructure and road improvements in the district. And while managing growth in the district and across the first state is about making improvements to transportation, Williams, for example, wants to see light rail connecting Delaware to neighboring states, both candidates take a view that's broader than roads and pipes. Williams wants to invest more in mental health infrastructure.
Specifically, I'm an individual that would like to build standalone mental health hospitals. What does that look like? I want to bifurcate people going into emergency rooms for medical emergencies compared to those that's going into the emergency room for mental health emergencies.
Another key to managing growth is managing the state's education system, something that Hensley says he's passionate about. And when it comes to schools, Hensley sees a couple of trouble areas. He's on a committee examining the state's funding system for public schools, and he sees a lot of room for improvement.
We currently, as a state, spend over $1 billion, so basically about 20% of our state's budget on education, and we're failing miserably. We're in the top six of what we spend per pupil, and we're in the bottom six for results.
He also zeroes in on not just how the system is funded, but how to pay for those new schools that need to be built for those new incoming students. Right now, a lot of times, that construction spending comes back to the voters in the form of a referendum. Hensley doesn't like that.
Frankly, I think we need to look at coming up with a funding mechanism that affords the districts the opportunity to build the necessary buildings to accommodate the growth, but at the same time, not have to go back to the taxpayers. In the case of Appaquinimic, every 2 to 3 years.
Williams is also thinking about education as he campaigns and how to expand career pathways for students. Williams, an Army veteran, says he wants to prepare students to succeed on the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, or ASVAB, a test that prospective enlistees take to help them find a military specialty.
One of my biggest ideas for education right now is to create a senior course, a year-long course from September to May that helps students that want to enter into the military be able to pass the ASVAB exam the first time around.
College isn't for everyone, Williams says.
We do not have a strong, robust curriculum out there for kids that want to join the unions, for kids that just want to go out and, you know what, I'm going to go work this job, my 40 hours a week, support my family and call it a day, or for those kids that want to go into the military.
One major issue that the candidates say is sharply dividing the district is gun regulation. Terrell Williams says it's top of mind in the 9th District, especially among more conservative voters that he meets.
I think the overwhelming issue centers around the Second Amendment and guns, access to guns. And the one thing I tell people all the time is when it comes to guns in America, that we all are going to have to make a collective sacrifice for the safety and well-being of everyone.
Hensley says he's concerned by the rising number of school shootings. We spoke just weeks after a shooting near Atlanta, Georgia, killed 4 people and injured 9 others.
We hear about these horrific events throughout the country. I lay awake at night worrying that I never want to wake up to a headline of something catastrophic happening here in Delaware.
Hensley points to his work in the House in creating a school safety fund.
I've been fortunate to sponsor 2 bills, one to create a school safety and security fund, the other one to add additional things that folks can use the fund for. I've been able to secure over $20 million over the course of the last several years for that fund.
Williams takes a moderated approach to gun regulations. As he admits,
people in the 9th District love their guns. They love their Second Amendment rights. And I'm not a person that wants to infringe on anyone's right to gun ownership.
But he does say he puts collective safety first.
Gun safety over individual rights, right? So collectively, what sacrifices are we willing to make? Me personally do not believe that there's a place for the average citizen to own an assault rifle.
As the campaign season lurches into its final weeks, both candidates are making their case to the voters at their doorsteps, on the streets, and at events. They both done this before, just 2 years ago, but things feel different this time around. One change in this rapidly changing district is the tone of the politics, driven by a more divisive national politics and bruising primaries just last month. Hensley admits the tenor of the rhetoric has gotten more strained in recent years.
It's clearly become more challenging. You know, the discord has become more toxic.
Williams agrees. He says that some voters are feeling left out, but he sees his campaign as part of the solution.
There's a large segment of our population that feel ignored and not seen by our government. And it takes people like me to reassure that they are seen, that they are heard, that they have a place in our democracy.
The 9th District, like the MOT area it's part of, is growing and changing. Meanwhile, the two men who are fighting to represent it, the Republican incumbent Hensley and the Democratic challenger Williams, are doing some growing and changing of their own, changing minds, and growing a winning majority. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Martin Matheny.
Thanks, Martin. Up next, we stay in New Castle County to continue our Races to Watch series with a look at House District 22, where another incumbent Republican hopes to fend off a Democratic challenger as Democrats pursue a supermajority in the State House of Representatives. You're listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon. We continue our Races to Watch series with another key race in New Castle County. Republican State Representative Mike Smith is running for re-election in the 22nd House District and is being challenged by political newcomer Monica Beard as the Democrats seek to flip this seat in their pursuit of a supermajority in the State House of Representatives. Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry takes a closer look at the state of play in this race.
Mike Smith was first elected to the seat in 2018, taking over for Republican Joe Miro, who retired after 20 years in the House. This district has long been a Republican stronghold in the face of the blue wave of New Castle County. The district itself includes Hocassin, Mill Creek, and North Star, and it's just north of Pike Creek. As of October 1st, there were 21,123 registered voters in the 22nd House District, with just over 8,200 registered as Democrats, almost 6,500 registered as Republicans, and almost 6,400 registered as others. Smith and before him Miro have been effective in courting the district's independent voters over the years, and that's a challenge facing Monica Beard in this race. Convincing more independents than previous Democratic candidates have in recent years in his district. Beard is running because Roe versus Wade was overturned, and she felt an urgency to think about who is representing Delawareans at a local level as more decisions are being made by states. She's also running to push political leaders in Dover to address domestic violence issues.
But I often felt like there was a divide between what was happening on the ground and those of us who are doing that service work and politicians in Dover. I would feel frustrated sometimes when a politician would come to a keynote at a conference and then leave after they spoke. I just felt like really the good information was what was happening at the conference.
Smith, who was first elected 6 years ago, ran for office in response to issues he personally faced as a caregiver for his grandmother, who raised him while starting his own family.
Working at the University of Delaware on the Star campus, kind of rebuilding what the future of Delaware is going to look like after, you know, losing the car manufacturing sites and some of the middle class. It just seemed like I was well positioned to focus on some of the issues that were really important to our state and most importantly to our district. And we've done a lot of good work together. And it's one of those things, too, as you continue on a path, it's not a path I want to continue on forever. I am a believer in you get in, you work for a period of time, and then you get out.
As for getting out, he's not ready yet, but he doesn't feel like this is a lifetime position, noting that he and his family are committed to do it another term or two. Smith sees health care, economic development as issues important to his constituents, with the economy as a whole topping the list in changing Delaware. Another key issue, school safety.
The safety of the teachers from students and also the safety from student to student. So that's been something that's been popping up, and I think you can look at it as a symptom of a lot of things. Some of it's coming out of COVID and resocialization. Some of it is some of the laws on the books already. Some of it is just lack of respect and learning what it means to respect another human being, respect a person in authority.
Beard says she sees a few other issues that are important to residents in the 22nd House District.
Everyone is very concerned about reproductive rights after Roe versus Wade was overturned. I think I'm also hearing a lot that people are concerned about gun violence. It's an issue that has become too worrisome in schools around the country, and a lot of parents are thinking about it here.
And Beard has some thoughts on what kind of legislation she would prioritize if she does get elected.
I think we really need to reexamine how we pay people who contract with the government who do essential work. I get frustrated when we realize that the people who, for example, investigate the most horrific child abuse aren't necessarily paid a living wage. if we believe and value our children, we need to make sure that we are taking that seriously and treating it as the essential career that it is.
If Smith returns to Dover, he says he has some unfinished business, such as legislation approving direct shipment of wine to Delawareans, which he feels is already moving in the right direction. He also wants Delaware to move to open primaries that allow independents to vote.
Allowing independents to vote in primaries, a lot of people don't realize that when they go to get their license, they're automatically registered to vote at DMV through AVR. And then that allows them to then predetermine if they want to vote in the Republican or Democratic primary before primary. So we're kind of already doing it. So that gives us a good positioning to do that. And I think we'd be able to do that. I think we have a lot to do in terms of education.
Whoever is elected will face challenges in Dover. In Beard's case, she would be a newly elected representative dealing with lawmakers as colleagues for the first time in her career. And that doesn't just mean learning to reach across the aisle at Legislative Hall.
But in some ways, a victim of your own success is that there can be incredible debate and disagreement and discussion within the party as much as there is between the party. So when I look at bipartisanship and working collaboratively, it's not just lurking with Republicans, but it's making sure that everyone from the most liberal Democrats to the most conservative Republicans.
As long as State Representative Smith has been in Dover, he's been in a minority party, so he realizes getting legislation passed requires a more moderate approach to draw Democrats to his side, something he's comfortable doing.
To me, it hasn't been hard to navigate Dover because I've always felt that relationships are the way that you get anything done. And I think that's why I have been able to navigate things across the aisle and won the civility award through the Biden Institute and won a bipartisanship award through the Future Caucus and things like that, because I like working across the aisle.
Both candidates agree on one thing, and that is the vitriol often seen, especially in national politics, needs to be tamped down. They each feel separating vitriol from legitimate policy disagreement is not only what's best for constituents, but for lawmakers everywhere. As she makes her closing arguments to voters in a 22nd House district, she wants them to consider putting children first.
I think it is so important that we think about what is still going on with our children in this state. I think a lot about how the most recent point in time count shows that so many of our children are homeless, so many of them are still hungry. I think that that is something that we can do more about. And I think by electing someone who's been working in those spaces, who does a job with children who are dealing with trauma, who are dealing with abuse, is something that is really important to make our state a more responsive one.
Beard adds she is honored to be on the ballot with other women like Kyle Evans-Gay, the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, and presidential candidate Kamala Harris. She notes that with more women running for office and winning in Delaware and around the country, that leads girls in her district to see a place in politics in the future. Smith's final message is a plea to come together.
Vote for moderate instead of extreme. And let's continue to build a better Delaware together. I'm a glass half full person. I don't think things are ever going to be perfect, and I don't think they're all totally bad either. But we need to create our own experience together. We need your lived experience, your life experience, your perspective that you bring with mine around a table together, and we need to get it done together.
Smith says he's proud of forming the Life Sciences Caucus because life, bio, and health science offer great careers that can be high paying, adding two-year degrees that can lead to advanced degrees to do more, and he believes focusing on these kinds of careers will help Delaware's economy. Joe Irizarry, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Joe. And stay with us, we get an update on where Delaware stands with PFAS contamination as the state continues to battle the presence of the so-called forever chemicals in its water supply. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon. Delaware's efforts to manage the presence of so-called forever chemicals in its water seem to be on the right track. The latest EPA testing for PFAS in the first state produced some encouraging results, with most samples meeting the strict new federal health limits, but there are still some areas of concern based on this latest testing. Contributor John Hurdle has been following Delaware's work to address PFAS contamination for several years, and he dives into the test numbers and reaction to them in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And earlier this week, John joined DPM News Director Tom Byrne to discuss what he learned.
So, John, let's start with the headline here. The latest EPA testing results of PFAS in the state show Delaware is doing fairly well when it comes to meeting the new strict federal health limits on these chemicals. In broad strokes, what did these latest EPA results find?
Well, what they found was that only 6% of about 3,100 tests of Delaware water's public water systems during 2023 and 2024 showed any trace of PFAS. So that's pretty good. And then a smaller share of the total was only 2.5% showed that PFAS present at levels that experts say could be a threat to public health. So those are the headlines on this very large set of data from EPA, which was put out in an ongoing test called the Uncontaminated Monitoring Rule number 5.
So, John, just to remind people, Delaware had set its own PFAS contamination standards, but it's now using these stricter federal limits, correct? And can you just give us a difference, what the difference is between what Delaware was going to do with now what they are doing with the federal limits?
Well, Delaware passed its own law in 2021, which set its own limits for two kinds of PFAS in drinking water. And the context here is that there was growing public concern that these chemicals were actually a threat to public health. There was at that time no federal regulation. And so a number of states took it on themselves to set their own limits. And those included Delaware. But since the Delaware law was passed, the EPA has finally set its own health limits, which are actually much stricter than the ones which Delaware would have imposed. The two commonly found PFAS chemicals that Delaware was going to independently regulate were one called PFOA, and that was going to be at the limit in drinking water there was going to be 21 parts per trillion. Another one called PFOS, the limit there was going to be 14 parts per trillion. It's worth comparing those numbers with those that the EPA just finalized back in April of this year, in which they imposed a limit of just 4 parts per trillion for each of those chemicals.
Based on the test results that we saw from EPA, what is the state saying about how it's doing on this issue?
Well, I mean, I think it's essentially they're working on it. They have acknowledged that that the EPA data, which, by the way, was released in July of this year, that the EPA data shows some PFAS in some systems. And the state, where specifically the Department of Public Health and DENREC, they're working together on this, and their efforts include seeking federal funding to help utilities install filtration. I mean, that's millions of dollars right there. And they're advising utilities and households on how to remove PFAS from their water systems and identifying the systems that have the most contaminants.
You mentioned the water utilities, and they are obviously frontline on dealing with mitigating PFAS contamination. And your story notes that there's some optimism about how water utilities are responding to these stricter federal standards. Where do they stand with complying to the standards that they're now being forced to meet?
Well, as I guess the EPA data show, most of Delaware's water utilities have installed or are in the process of installing PFAS filters, and those are technology that removes these chemicals down to low levels and hopefully to levels that comply with the federal limits. And by the way, those federal limits are actually not effective until 2029. So the utilities have another 5 years in order to make those things effective. A couple of examples of Delaware utilities that have installed that filtration include Artesian Water. Now that's a major investor-owned utility that has about 300,000 customers in all three Delaware counties. And at the other end of the scale, the Newcastle Municipal Services Commission, it's a publicly owned water utility, and that just has around about 2,200 customers. Both of those utilities say that they have reduced the PFAS content, or at least the content for the at least those two regulated chemicals to within the federal limits.
So despite this overall positive news, there do remain some areas for concern, particularly in places where we know there has been substantial PFAS contamination previously. One, of course, is in the Newcastle area that you just mentioned, specifically near the Air National Guard base where the military previously used firefighting foam containing PFAS. What do we know about the situation in Newcastle now with that kind of PFAS hotspot?
Well, PFAS was found in the Newcastle area in 2014. Their utilities installed filters, as I just mentioned, the Municipal Services Commission says it has been essentially PFAS free since then. Now, Newcastle was one of eight communities around the country near military bases that were tested by the CDC in a national program back in 2019. And what that meant was that in Newcastle's case is that about 200 people had their blood and urine tested for five different PFAS chemicals. And it was found that that nearly all of the participants had those chemicals at above the national average level. So this was this pointed the finger very firmly towards the contamination that resulted from the military's use of this firefighting foam.
And you had a chance to talk to some residents in that area for this story who remain concerned about the impact of PFAS on their health. What did they tell you?
Well, essentially what they told me is that they are worried about the idea that they drank water which may have contained PFAS a long time ago before PFAS became a public health concern. I mean, I spoke with one gentleman who is he's 62 years old. He's lived in Newcastle for nearly all his life. And he said that, you know, when he was growing up as a child, they drank water. He said they drank lots of water. It was never a thought that there might be any contaminants in it. And now he says he doesn't have any health issues of his own, but he said he lost one brother to cancer, and another brother has recently been diagnosed with the same disease. So I think he was he's kind of typical. I mean, one other person that I spoke with on this is the pastor of a United Methodist Church, and she's been at that church for 8 years, and during that time she's had 53 of her congregants have actually died. Now, I mean, she's very quick to say that she has no proof that any of these deaths were related to contamination of the local water supply. She says that her gut tells her that there's something going on, and that she just wonders. I mean, having found out about the contamination and the ongoing efforts to keep that out of the water system now, maybe some of these people did actually fall victim to PFAS in the past. Now, we should also say that, PFAS chemicals are linked to a long list of serious health conditions, some cancers, decreased response to vaccines, elevated cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, and a lot of very serious conditions. And so, this is the basis for some of this local concern.
How about, John, around Dover Air Force Base? That's another known PFAS hotspot. What is the status of what's going on around the Air Force Base?
Well, indeed, very high levels of PFAS were found in groundwater there starting in 2016. And those were, in some places, those were actually thousands of times higher than the federal limits. And so since then, the military has been working to clean it up. They've installed what they call POETS, point of entry treatment systems, on a number of properties there which are off base but are seen as having had their own private water supplies contaminated by the chemicals that were used on base. What the military says is that those systems are a very effective way of filtering out those chemicals. They're also, the military also says that they're working with the city of Dover to connect affected properties with city water systems, so they don't have to worry about making their own arrangements. They're continuing to investigate.
John, what's next for the state with testing and mitigation? Is there anything we should be watching for on the horizon as the state continues, as you said, to work on this situation that's a work in progress?
Well, it is a work in progress. So, first of all, there's going to be more testing by the EPA. I mean, this big slew of test results that we've recently had is part of an ongoing series of national tests, and there will be more done in Delaware and elsewhere. There'll be more investigation by state agencies, and there'll be more applications by the state to the federal government for assistance with the cost of installing the filtration systems, which are very expensive, you know. Just yesterday, I had a conversation with the head of environmental health at the Department of Public Health, and she said, well, you know, whichever way you cut it, this is going to be a heavy lift in terms of the expense. And she said that even at an individual level, if an individual household with a private well seeks to install their own PFAS filter, it's probably going to cost them several thousand dollars to do that.
So, John, overall, should people be feeling better about where Delaware stands on PFAS levels based on all the people you've talked to for this story?
Well, I think that the data shows most Delaware water systems do meet the federal PFAS standards, even though, as I said, those standards are not strictly effective for another 5 years. But for the few that don't meet the standards, I think there's a few things that people can do. To bear in mind, one is that the utilities are in the process of installing those systems if they haven't already. The individuals can actually take their own steps to protect themselves against any contamination in the water. But there's an important caveat to all this in that private well owners represent about one fifth of the population of the whole state, round about 200,000 people. And those private wells are not regulated, and so any mitigation effort for those wells has to be undertaken by those individuals themselves.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle and Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne for joining us. And The Green wraps up next with Enlighten Me, where we examine why the once invisible threat of salt in Delaware's water is getting worse and what's being done about it. You're listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon. Saltwater was once known as an invisible threat. It would sneak under the soil in farms and fields until it got so far into the groundwater that the soil became too salty, killing crops and flooding farmland, the result of what's known as seawater intrusion. But the once invisible threat of saltwater is now very much visible in Delaware as seawater travels further up small tidal streams during storms and high tides. And as the effects of climate change get more intense, and as population growth stresses freshwater supplies, seawater intrusion is expected to only get worse, and viable solutions are scarce. For this week's edition of Enlighten Me, I sat down with environmental geographer and associate professor at the University of Delaware, Pinky Mondal, to explore seawater intrusion in the state and how it's being addressed. You've done a lot of research on seawater intrusion in Delaware, which has been an issue in Delaware for a while now. It's not unique to Delaware, but Delaware is indeed a state and a region where it's prominent. But when we say seawater intrusion, what exactly do we mean? What causes it to happen?
So seawater intrusion, also known as saltwater intrusion, is a complex process. And it happens for many different reasons. And really, geography plays a very important part of it. Some of the factors that decide on the degree of saltwater intrusion is definitely sea level rise, land subsidence, frequency of powerful coastal storms, but also how we manage our land. So, groundwater extraction or fertilizer or having canals that are bringing in excess saltwater from the ocean on our farmlands. So depending on where we are, as you have identified, it's not unique to Delaware, but we have been hearing more and more of coastal saltwater intrusion in Delaware, in Maryland, Virginia, Carolinas, but also outside of the US, Vietnam, Bangladesh. So definitely something to be concerned about.
Right. And as an issue unto itself, then why, and you touched on this a bit, but why is seawater intrusion, saltwater intrusion, why is it so damaging? You know, broad strokes, what are the ripple effects if left unchecked?
You know, we can start thinking about how it happens. And as I mentioned, it's a complex process, but we can look at it as mainly two ways. One is how our seawater is getting into our fresh groundwater reserves, and then through plants, the salt is making its way up on the soil surface. Another way to look at it would be how saltwater from the ocean is coming onto our farmland, so more working at the surface level and also shallow groundwater. Now, before, it was mostly a groundwater-driven process, and that's why it used to be invisible. So we would not know. We knew, you know, crops were dying, plants were dying, but there could be so many other reasons. So for a long, long period, especially here in Delmarva, we were not sure because there were no visible signs. And, you know, famously, we used to call it invisible flood. So it would, right now, you can actually see visible salt patches on the soil surface. And that gives you a stunning clue into this silent disease. It's not silent anymore. Now we are seeing crops dying, but also that piece of land is completely bare because the salinity is so high that no plant can survive there. Depending on what kind of plant we are talking about, especially if we are thinking about working lands and our crop lands, especially in Delaware and Delmarva, it's a corn-soybean economy, and corn especially does not like salty water or salty soil. Soybean does a little better, but not too much. In countries like Vietnam or Bangladesh, they have been dealing with this issue for a very long time, but rice is also known to be a little more salt tolerant. Even then, the salinity is so high there that they are seeing a reduction in crop yield for decades. So it depends where we are and what kind of landscape we are talking about. Definitely, if we are talking about traditional agriculture here in Delmarva, it cannot take that kind of high salinity that we are recording these days farther inland.
Can you give us a sense then of the severity here in the state as far as seawater intrusion goes? I know I started off saying that it's not unique to Delaware, but as far as Delaware goes, what's the severity here?
So we recently published a study looking at, you know, the spread and cost of saltwater intrusion. And basically what we did, we looked at aerial images from 2011 and 2017. And within those years, we documented thousands of hectares, depending on where you are, that got salinized. How did we capture that? Using machine learning. So we trained the computers to identify those visible salt patches that were invisible before, in earlier years. But now we can capture that and we can train the machine to look through aerial images over multiple years to see how that's progressing. And it's quite alarming because it not only doubled the number of salt patches, but also the area of salt patches. If you look at just the area, it's still quite small, but there's another issue here because, as I mentioned, not everywhere you will see the salt patches, which is bright white, looks almost like white beach sand, but it's around the farmland. There's another indicator, or as we call proxy for salinity, is how we are seeing the salt-tolerant species. Meaning, when salinity takes over, your traditional crops or regular plant cannot withstand that kind of salinity. Another plant that loves salt, that takes over that land. And if you look at some of our agricultural land, you would see Phragmites growing in the middle of a farmland and nothing else is growing. So the marsh, how that's taking over our agricultural land, that can be used as another proxy even when we do not see the salt patches. And exactly that's what we looked at, and we definitely saw a progressively higher percentage of marshlands taking over our agricultural land. So something that was agricultural land back in 2011 now have already converted into marshland in 2017. And since 2017, there are even more lands that are going through this, and something that will come out soon, we are working on another study where we'll be publishing data on how we are seeing this happening since 2017 until 2023.
Looking at contributing factors per se, we're having quite a hurricane season at the moment. There was Helene, now there's Milton. I'm guessing that this, hurricanes or be it storm surges, they just blow this issue right open, right?
That's a great question. So it also depends on the soil property that we are talking about. Different soil soaks up salt in different ways. What we are seeing, especially with Helene or Milton, they will probably dump a lot of salt water onto our lands. Whether that can be drained or washed away, that depends on many different factors. So we do see one of these episodic events, as we call it. Those are not frequent, but happens once in a while, and that will bring on the salt water onto our farmlands. Now, if we have another, let's say, rainfall event, that can take the excess salt away. And that's how it's supposed to be, right? It used to happen in the past that you would have this, once in 10 years, 20 years event that will bring excess water, but then it can also get washed away. You can also use irrigation to wash away excess salt. But then we have to think about how compound will affect the agricultural land. So in one way, you are getting more and more saline groundwater. Then you are dealing with this more frequent coastal storm. Then you also have these canals and ditches that are acting as a conduit in a regular time where you have a little bit of high tide and you are getting this excess water onto the coastal farmland. And then you also have, excessive groundwater pumping that's not helping with the situation. And we are also having like this land that are subsiding. It's a very slow subsidence rate, but still, and all these lands are very close to coastline. So all these factors sometimes work in together in tandem, and it's very difficult to identify one single factor that will play a significant role, but definitely this, catastrophic events like, very powerful coastal storms, definitely are gonna have an effect on bringing in more and more salt water that these lands cannot really survive through.
Yeah, there's a lot of ripple effects here. There's just a lot going on here and a lot of factors. How can it be addressed then, or what's being done about it in Delaware for both the short and the long term?
So it depends on which stage of salinity we are in. If it's a very early level salinity, a lot of people prefer to use short-term measures. So for example, they can add something to their land that will balance out the salt. Many people, they like to put in like some tide gate so that, the excess salt water just, can stay away. But the issue with that is many of these short terms are really band-aid solution. When we are dealing with some of these effects that are very long-term, we have to think about our future, what's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years. So while some of these are really good way to work with this issue, for now and for maybe next 5 years, what we have to think about that for how long we can maintain this, because if it's working land, there's a return on investment that we have to think about. At some point, this management will become so expensive that there will be no way people can maintain this land in this working condition, like the traditional way. But then it also becomes the issue of landowners' management preferences and what they want out of this land. You know, many of the coastal lands have been in smallholder farmer families, and sometimes they're very attached to the land. Some people are very spiritually and, you know, culturally connected to these lands. But I think it's very important that when we make decisions about lands, it's very important to involve the landowners and just to give them all the tools from our science and our current research to talk about some of the potential solutions. There are some, you know, conservation easement programs where I know these organizations are working with landowners to see if there could be alternate land uses. So it's almost like, do we want to work against nature? And if that's the case, for how long we can maintain that relationship? Or should we just work with nature and see for how long we can save this land for our future generations? So it's a very tricky situation, and there's no easy solution, unfortunately, but it really depends on which salinity stage we are in.
Working against nature as opposed to working with it. I'm just curious, are there any, in terms of solutions staying with this, are there any other like states or any other areas across the globe that we can look to in terms of how they're addressing this issue? Or again, it's just something that's complex and everyone's just kind of in the same boat here?
So I feel like a lot of countries, they have been dealing with this issue for a very long time, especially like Bangladesh. They have been dealing with this for decades. The issue is that it looks like a losing battle because they will be also another low-lying country and losing a lot of land to open water. And it almost becomes a question of survival. Do you want to save yourself, your families, or do you want to save the land? And depending on where you are, which country you are in, whether you can get access to any loss and damage fund, there's not a lot of money for our adaptation and mitigation. When we are trying to address climate change related issues, money matters, because as a landowner, I'd like to see how much money I can get if I go for option one versus option two. So I feel like we know a lot about this issue, but we are still kind of trying to figure out what are the best ways, or maybe a suite of best options. Everything that I've seen so far, it's almost like catching up. Some people have even thought about putting like a wall, you know, in the coastal cities. But think about how many billion of US dollars that will require. And then do we even have that kind of money, especially for a losing battle? So I think it's very, very important that policymakers, landowners, scientists, they come together and just be in a room to just discuss what are the feasible options that are economic, that are sustainable, and that is looking forward, not like looking backward. Because something that might have worked 10 years ago definitely would not work in the next 10, 20 years. And something that we often say, you know, within our academic circle, the time for action was yesterday. So I would like to be a little more positive, and I would like to say the time for action is now, but it's now. We need to do something wrong. We cannot wait for another 5 years.
Thanks to UD professor and environmental geographer Pinky Mondal for enlightening us this week. And that's it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also love to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas at our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. And a big thanks to Delaware Public Media's Tom Byrne, Martin Matheny, Joe Irizarry, and contributor John Hurdle for helping make this week's show possible. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Kyle McKinnon, saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned in to a first state of mind.